This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. We got started a little late today, guys. I'm sorry. We had some technical difficulties. You were listening to Balance of Power talking about the jobs report, and we'll get to that in the U.S. But right now, it's just past 5 o'clock over in London. It's just past 12 o'clock here in the United States. I'm Alex Steele. Guy Johnson's off today. Kriti Gupta joins me now in the studio. Just a couple headlines. It's the jobs day. It was solid. People are calling it Goldilocks. Equity rally underway. You also have some price caps being discussed on Russian oil. That's going to be really fascinating in terms of what it does to inflation and also what the retaliation could be. Plus, OPEC's meeting next week. They're going to be very confused about that as well. And we're T-minus, what, 3 days, 2 days until we get the new prime minister over in the UK. We will break that down as well for you. That's sort of a snapshot of where we are. Let's get more headlines here with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. The cost of the most basic standard of living has jumped by 20% in Britain as the country faces the biggest squeeze on household budgets in a generation. That is about six times the pace of the average annual increase each previous year since 2009, according to a university report funded by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Britain, meanwhile, has dropped behind India to become the world's sixth largest economy, delivering a further blow to the government in London as it grapples with a brutal cost of living shock. India leaped past the UK in the final 3 months of 2021 to become the fifth biggest economy. That calculation is based in US dollars, and India extended its lead for the first quarter, according to GDP numbers from the International Monetary Fund. And the group of seven most industrialized countries say they do plan to implement a price cap for global purchases of Russian oil, a measure the U.S. hopes will slash Moscow's overall revenues, but has so far been treated with skepticism in the oil market. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
Charlie Pellett, thank you so very much. Kriti Gupta joining me here in studio. Also on the phone with us is Vincent Signorella, a voice of Bloomberg Macro Audio Squawk, to talk about the Fed, jobs, and also looking ahead to the ECB. Kriti, you know, I gotta say, it's a Friday before Labor Day weekend. I wanted something cool in the jobs report. I wanted drama. I don't feel like I got a lot of drama.
It is kind of a...
It was good. That's great.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It is kind of a been there, done that kind of vibe.
Things
to
are
it.
Good. Okay, yeah. And?
And now what? I think what's interesting is the nuance here. You have to pay attention to when it comes to the market trade. You really have to nerd out if you are trading this market and look at, are you trading on the participation rate? Mm-hmm. Are you trading on the hourly wages? Which, by the way, if you look at on a real basis, Dan Curtis did the math for us, it's actually negative. So that's not really good news. But then if you look at the participation rate, it's better. So I guess people like that. But then again, we've had five negative days. So there was already this buildup.
Yeah,
baked like, in.
Negativity was already priced in. The dollar was also at a record high. If you're looking at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, Vince, what are you trading on?
What Kriti just said is the market like this these numbers. They were calling it Goldilocks. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. But when you're looking at earnings come down, we've seen multiple indicators of inflation pricing coming off. We saw it again yesterday in the prices paid with ISM manufacturing. ISM services is down. Home prices are down. This morning, Vancouver announced home sales down 40% year over year. Prices still up, but clearly people are pushing back on these price increases and slowing spending in various areas. And I think the Fed needs to come to the realization that the market's going to do a lot of this work for it.
You know what's so interesting, Vince? So it's so interesting here is that I almost felt like we had a precursor to what the equity reaction would be, because when Snapchat came out and said, we're going to reduce our workforce by 20%, their stock rallied. When 3M said the same thing, not by 20%, but they said they're talking about layoffs, their stock rallied. It's interesting that the equity market is almost rewarding some of these companies for a cost-cutting kind of story. And at the same time, you still have a manufacturing sector that's doing pretty well. What is there to worry about in
Vince
the jobs
worries
market.
About a lot, man. I mean, he's not any
Oh, I know. He's the contrarian. He's the resident contrarian.
No, I think when you look at the jobs market, you're actually seeing corporate America react to what has been going on in the last year or so, which is a lagging indicator. They're starting to react to the fact that their earnings are lower. Major large corporates do not hedge their dollar exposure. As a result, every time the dollar goes up, they get spanked. And there were some really bad effects to earnings in the last quarter that American companies reported, based on FX, the FX hit. I think that now they have to look at other areas of cutting costs. The easiest way to do it is employees. Mm-hmm. And they're doing exactly what the market wants them to do, which is to maintain their earnings per share. And the easiest way for them to do it is to cut heads, especially if you're not selling as much of whatever you're producing that you were 6 months ago.
Okay, so Fed, 50 or 75 next meeting, and then let's go to the ECB after that.
You know, I don't know that 50 or 75 is that big a deal for the next meeting. The fact that they're going to go and it's preordained is in the cards. I almost hope they go 75 because that puts them in the sweet spot of the neutral rate of between 3 and 3.5. I just don't think they go again. You know, I've said that before. I think now when you see all the indicators, commodity prices, home prices, crude, Alex, your wheelhouse. What are we down 25% from the highs?
Mm-hmm.
Energy prices in Europe, gas futures down 25%, even as we approach winter and all this talk about Russia. If we have a mild winter, this is all for naught. And we're going to have, I think, an excellent fourth quarter rally in equities.
I want to switch to the ECB because next week we are going to get Christine Lagarde and Chairman Powell speaking at the exact same time. And I know there's been a lot of conversation about which one is going to be more newsworthy. Vince, who's going to be more newsworthy?
I think you have to stick with Powell. And the key to Powell's speech is going to be not so much that he's going to reiterate what he has been saying. Is he going to at least give a nod to where the economic data have been going and make any kind of a suggestion that they are data dependent once again? The speech prior to the last one, he leaned in that direction. The markets rallied like crazy. They loved it. They thought there was a potential pivot down the road. I think he really does need to say it. I don't know that he will, but you know, clearly the data is pointing to the Fed pausing after September. And if they want to keep running red lights and just going blindly ahead, they're going to run into something pretty hard. There's going to be a crash at the end of it, and it's likely to be the U.S. economy.
Oh, okay, fine, fair enough. But the ECB could hike 75 basis points next week. That would be huge.
Yes and no. They're just really following what the rest of the central banks are doing.
Is that priced in? Do you think a 75 bip hike is priced in?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, traders are definitely pricing in 75 basis points. 50 would be a surprise. But if you look at the European economies, the Lagarde and the ECB are kind of in a bigger box or a tighter box, I should say, than the Fed is in. You know, with everything that's going on in Ukraine and whatever is going on in the European economies, they can't just blindly raise rates, ad hoc and without taking into account what's going on around them. I realize they're worried about inflation, but let's be realistic. We haven't had inflation in 20 years. We have inflation for 6 months and everybody's panicking like we're going back to the 70s. I mean, we're not going back. This isn't the 70s.
Vince, you said it's priced in. 75 basis points are priced in, yet I'm looking at a euro.
At parity.
Yeah. So explain the math there.
So foreign exchange doesn't always trade on interest rates. That's the first thing people need to understand. It's part and parcel. There are two currencies that really, really, really affect or trade with interest rates very closely. The biggest, of course, is the Japanese yen, and that's followed by the Canadian dollar. And the Canadian dollar also has the oil component, so it switches back and forth as to what's really the main factor, which is moving the Canadian dollar. Is it crude prices or is it the interest rate differential? As far as Europe is concerned, there's much bigger dynamics that are going on within the European economies and with what's going on, obviously, in Ukraine that are affecting the euro, and it's not really an interest rate story. The divergence between the interest rates isn't wide enough to make interest rates the major story for Europe.
Hmm. Hmm. That's what I have to say about that. Okay, Vince, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Okay, parody. There you go. All right, Vince Zignarella of Bloomberg Micro Audio Squawk. Thank you very much. Working on the Fed, the jobs, and looking ahead to the ECB. Let's stay in Europe for a moment. The big news overnight was that the G7 have reached a deal on Russian oil price caps. The idea is they're going to set the price of Russian oil that's going to be bought on the market by those that agree to this. It's going to be just above the marginal cost of production. It's going to be one price for actual Russian crude and another price for actual Russian products. Therefore, you can still get the stuff you need, but at a price that may wind up hurting Russia. A couple questions. Will Russia actually sell them the oil? And what do the likes of India or China do? Are they really going to want to pay any more for Russian oil? Are they just going to pay what the price cap is? So lots of questions into this, and which, if it will actually work. And this is ahead, of course, of the embargo on Russian oil that's supposed to take place on December 5th. So let's get more on this. Roz Matheson joins us now from Bloomberg. Hey, Roz, walk us through what you know so far about this proposal from the G7.
Well, as you said, they finally agreed after some months ago. They said they'd take a proper look at it, and now they've agreed to implement it. And the question is, you know, it is how? There's no dollar ranges yet for an eventual cap, but a goal is to have it all sorted by December 5 when those EU sanctions on Russian oil are due to kick in. So between now and then, there's a lot they've got to sort out, which is, for one thing, exactly what these price ranges might be for this cap, as you noted, on crude, but also on refined products. There's a need to get the EU states all over the line on this to also agree, because that requires them to change their sanctions regime. It's the reaction of China and India and other major buyers of Russian crude, and will they get on board? Unlikely. Or will they at least sort of tolerate the system as it may be? And then in somehow will actually be effective in that case if a lot of countries don't join up to it. So there's a lot of questions and a lot of work to be done between now and December 5 beyond today's agreement to work out exactly how this is going to work and then how countries are going to implement it.
So is that what's needed? Some sort of support or something from, I want to say, the friendlier countries to Russia to really have this proposition taken seriously?
Well, that's right. And it's been pretty clear so far that India has been reluctant to sign up to it. Of course, they've been directly negotiating discounted energy products from Russia and benefiting from that. But their concern is that in an environment like a price cap, you're then competing with other countries for that discounted Russian crude. So India's not that keen so far, it seems, to sign up. Of course, China is just not keen to sign up to anything that smacks of sanctions in general. They're being careful to not overstep on the sanctions that have been implemented by other nations against Russia, but equally, they don't want to be seen to be endorsing these systems,
right.
And they like to go their own way. So,
Ross, can I jump in here really quickly?
How they get joined up.
What's the point, then?
Well, the point is, as you said, just to try and put a little bit of pain on Russia in terms of this revenue that's been coming in for months since they invaded Ukraine on the energy side. Like, they're trying at least to put some pressure on. And the question is, as you say, how much will this impact? Because the sanctions that they've put in place so far arguably haven't stopped Russia in its tracks. If anything, the economy has been more resilient than people expected.
Well, here's my other question, and this might be a really silly one, but from my understanding, the oil embargo is supposed to take place December 5th. So why do we need the price caps and an oil embargo?
Well, the oil embargo would just be with EU states, and this is within the broader G7 grouping. So, of course, includes the US and Japan and Canada in that. And that is just designed to have a slightly bigger net around Russia when it comes to its oil export.
Okay, fair enough. In the meantime, I think it's worth noting J.P. Morgan talked about the fact that about 2.7 million barrels of oil from Russia are still going to the European Union. It's significant. It's down from where it was, which is 4 million barrels of oil. But still, it is quite significant. How easily replaceable do we know, Roz, could that oil wind up being? How replaceable is it?
Well, it's not easily replaceable, and that's the question. That's why you can imagine, like, particularly countries like Hungary are going to dig in here. There's absolutely no guarantee that Hungary is going to sign up to it. We saw how difficult they were on coal as a starting point. They've said that oil is a red line. It will hurt its own economy too much. They can't get replacement from elsewhere. So it's going to be a very fraught couple of months getting all the EU states to agree, because Hungary's point is we can't just conjure up all this oil from elsewhere and then we'll be competing with each other to get oil from elsewhere. We've seen that already on gas as countries go around the world. You know, European nations are in Algeria and everywhere trying to secure gas. They'll be end up doing the same quite possibly for oil.
Yeah, that's why I'm having a really hard time understanding that the price caps are going to be inflationary or disinflationary, because I can see the case both ways. I mean, one hand, like you just said, then you have to go scramble for different oil if Russia says, I'm not going to sell it to you. That's going to push the regional differentials up for certain oil prices. On the other hand, if people agree to the oil price cap, it's going to suppress oil globally because no one's going to want to pay, you know, $100 more for oil when they can get it really cheaply. I can't quite get a read on it yet.
And that's what, yeah, economists are trying to get their heads around. It also will depend really at what price these things are set. And that's what not that's what's not understood yet, is how much over the cost of production these price caps are going to be set. Possibly not very much. But you can see so far real efforts by Saudi Arabia and Russia, sort of key players in the OPEC grouping, not to be too pushed around by the US and others on oil supply in order to affect prices. So even if a price cap does take effect, you can imagine that big suppliers like Saudi and others will still be looking to be able to support the market and get a decent price. So how much this could be deflationary really would remain to be seen as a result.
I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so, so much, Roz Matheson, joining us there on this confusing energy price cap scenario that we're trying to work our way through here for Russian oil distributed globally. Okay, the other big story that's happening in the UK is Monday, guys. You're going to get an official new prime minister, Rishi Sunak versus Liz Truss. The momentum seems to be going continued into Liz Truss's direction. She's currently foreign secretary and a former trade minister. And the UK is in a really, really bad spot. The cost of living increase is going crazy. Yields are moving higher. Energy prices still quite high. The BOE is going to hike. There's still the conversation about the Northern Ireland Protocol, as well as Article 16 and Brexit. So there's lots of stuff that needs to happen and that will be happening when the new prime minister takes over on Tuesday. So joining me to discuss is Therese Raphael, joining me from Bloomberg Opinion. Okay, Therese, what do you think is going to happen? Who's it going to be?
unless the polls are wildly wrong and there's no real indication they are, Liz Truss becomes prime minister on Monday. And, you know, it's a job you have to wonder who would actually want, given all of the, you know, crises, and I don't think crisis is too strong a word here, that are facing the new leader. This is a pretty tricky time, and you've just kind of run down the list. I think the two that are, you know, going to be top of her in tray is cost of living. We've been discussing that all week, and what sort of relief does she provide people for rising energy costs. But the second one is, as you've indicated, Northern Ireland, because on September 15th, suspension of some of the controls that are put in place because of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is the arrangement that allowed for an open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland to remain in place by keeping Northern Ireland in the EU's single market for goods. That whole arrangement is what Liz Truss and the Boris Johnson government before her, or that she's part of, have been challenging. And she has a number of ways in which she plans to bring that challenge to Brussels.
Here's a silly question. Do people care about the Northern Ireland Protocol anymore? Have they moved on? Are they fine with it?
So, interestingly, in Northern Ireland, it's becoming increasingly popular. The majority of the population actually think it's a good thing. They think it is, one of the best way to help Northern Ireland's economy. That economy is actually, on some, you know, counts, has been more advantaged after Brexit than the broader UK economy, which faces more trade frictions with the EU. So yes, the protocol is pretty popular in Northern Ireland. Of course, it is wildly unpopular with the Democratic Unionist Party and Unionist voices, who see it as creating a division between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And the Democratic Unionist Party has boycotted the power sharing arrangement and saying it will not rejoin that until the government pulls out of the protocol. So that has set up a sort of brinkmanship with Brussels, where, you know, Liz Truss can either use of the protocol, an article known as Article 16, to try to suspend the parts of it that the UK government argues aren't working, or she can push the nuclear button. And that is a piece of legislation that's going through the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which essentially unilaterally breaks Britain's obligations under the protocol. And I think if that happens, the EU's been very clear it sees, any negotiation as, pointless, because there would be a loaded gun at the table. So I think then we're talking a really different ballgame in UK-EU relations.
What do you think the economic ramifications of something like that would be when the economy is still so fragile? It feels like you're going to break something that's semi-broken in a time where everything else is broken.
Well, exactly. I mean, the protocol isn't perfect. There, it introduces some trade friction. I think there are ways that both sides could compromise to make it better. The alternative, which is a complete breakdown in relations, is pretty, cataclysmic. For Northern Ireland, it means, increased uncertainty, potentially political instability. The Northern Ireland already has about half of households in fuel poverty. It has the largest NHS wait list in the entire country. That would be a very bad thing. For broader UK-EU relationships, Europe is still Britain's largest trading partner. A breakdown in that relationship that could lead to retaliatory measures from the EU and a breach of the entire trade cooperation agreement, which is a post-Brexit trade deal. Well, it's really hard to see, any way that wouldn't be just disastrous for Britain. Obviously, it would hurt Europe as well, but that pain would be shared out among, 27 EU countries versus the UK. So we're back to all of those discussions we had a couple of years ago about the consequences of a no-deal Brexit. It shouldn't go there, but, we just don't know. And a lot of that is up to how Liz Truss handles this. And I think, early on, what the EU is going to look at is what is the tone of her communications on this? Is she looking for a way out or is she willing to just pull the trigger?
Do we think she's going to sort of come in and work on Tuesday like guns a-blazing, or and saying, I have mandates to do lots of things? Or do you think there's going to be a real tone to listen in any of these topics? Because, how much of the population is actually going to be electing the prime minister? Like, really small, right?
Yeah, it's very, very small. It's some 160,000 Tory party members. So it is a very small. I think she's going to want to signal to her own party that she's in control. She's going to want to signal to the right of her party that has really supported her along the way that she's not going to waver on Brexit. So I would expect some pretty tough language, and I would expect that she will trigger this Article 16 of the protocol. But remember, that's within the bounds of the treaty that's been agreed. So she's not blowing the treaty up by triggering Article 16. She's simply saying, we don't think this is working. And that triggers, a consultation, negotiation. Mm-hmm. She can only suspend a part of the protocol within that Article 16. So I would expect that to happen. Now, what happens beyond that and how she responds to the bill? And she introduced the second reading of the bill, the vote that we mm-hmm. saw in July. So she's been right behind that bill. And I think that's where the EU is going to watch very closely. The House of Lords will come back with some amendments. They really want to rip into what the government wants to do here, partly because they think it's a breach of international law, but also because they say that the bill arrogates to ministers way more powers than ministers should have. Mm-hmm. And they want to rein them in that way. So the House of Lords will have a say. How Truss responds will tell us a lot about her intentions.
Oh, man. Okay, Therese Raphael, thanks so much. You are so fabulous on this topic. I'm sure we'll be talking to you next week as well. Therese Raphael, a Bloomberg Opinion Countdown is continuing. Up next, we're going to dig more into the jobs numbers in the U.S. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. Happy Friday, everyone. We made it. It's just past 5:30 in London. It's 12:30 here in the U.S. I'm Alex Steele. Guy Johnson off today. Kriti Gupta in for Guy. Let's take a look at the equity markets here in the U.S. The S&P is up by about half a percentage point off the highs of the session. The Dow up by half a percent as well. The NASDAQ up by a quarter of 1%. You're also looking at that strong labor market number, but we are fading as we sort of head into this Labor Day weekend Friday. In the bond market, you saw some pretty indiscriminate buying, mostly focused, though, in that front end, so the curve a little bit steeper. Now you're seeing a touch of selling in the long end, 30-year yield up by about 1 basis point. Kriti, I now feel like it's a wait and see for that inflation data. I feel like next week is kind of about the ECB, and then we kind of get our feet wet again with the inflation number.
Yeah, you know, I think what's really interesting, and I would argue almost boring, is that we're just waiting for these next pivot points as opposed to something actually driving the story. I mean, isn't this the argument that Mike Wilson made to you actually on your show, that it's the macro that's driving all of the selling and the earnings stuff isn't even priced in?
No, and when do we do that?
Right.
Like, and then what's the trigger for that to happen? The earnings expectations come down, and then maybe we'd finally see a trough in markets. No one knows that. Ask anyone, they're like, it's going to happen sometime.
And just the day-to-day news on headlines and corporates, none of that is factoring in.
Yeah. All right, that's a snapshot of U.S. markets. Let's get another snapshot of the headlines around the world. Here's Charlie Pellet.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Britain's supply chains are poised for further delays after dock workers at Liverpool's container port say they will walk out for 2 weeks later this month over a pay dispute. The United Union says workers will strike from September 19th to October 3rd. Peel Ports Limited, which owns the Port of Liverpool, says its proposed pay package represented an 8.3% raise, while the union said it had rejected a 7% offer. Inflation, by the way, was up to 10.1% in July. Shell has shortlisted candidates to succeed CEO Ben Van Beurden, who is preparing to step down in 2023 after 40 years at the company. This according to Reuters, citing two unidentified people from the company. The 64-year-old has steered Shell through some of its most turbulent times. British employers stepped up recruitment last week in preparation for a rush at Christmas, bringing the summer lull in hiring to a swift end. The Recruitment and Employment Confederation said 2.08 million new jobs were advertised in the week to August 28th, the highest number for 2022 and the second highest on record. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
Thank you so much, Charlie Pellet. Here's a headline for you. I know this is a shocker, but Gazprom says that Nord Stream 1 is going to remain shut after a technical issue. It was going to be shut starting August 31st for 3 days. It was supposed to then reopen on Saturday. And sort of no surprise, there is another technical issue. I feel like this is potentially in response to that Russian oil price cap for oil that European nations and G7s are talking about. Russia kind of flexing its muscle. But this, will it or won't it come back? You know that's going to just continue. So even though we've seen, Kriti, a decline in energy prices, you have to wonder how sustainable it is when energy is still being held hostage across the globe.
And can I just point out that as we see that headline, we also see a fade in the euro. We're now below parity coming off of that headline. So interesting market reaction right there on a summer Friday, I might add.
Apparently there's an oil leak detected. And a gas pipeline is going to remain shut until those repairs made. Anyway, okay, back to the labor market. We talked about the market reaction and what the Fed might do. Let's get some take from the political reaction. Myself and Tom McKenzie on Bloomberg Television spoke with Cecilia Rouse. She is U.S. Council of Economic Advisors. And I asked her about what the White House is doing versus what the Fed is doing. To that point, Judy Shelton had a great op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And here's what she said. She said, the Fed could crush demand by raising interest rates to huge levels, only to have a spendthrift White House and complicit Congress pump up consumer prices through fiscal measures that expand spending power, cash payments, subsidies, rebates, and student loan forgiveness. And I asked Cecilia what she thought about that.
So look, the Inflation Reduction Act, which the president just signed into law, actually reduces our deficit going forward. It increases taxes on the very wealthiest and the wealthiest corporations, expands the powers of the Internal Revenue Service to be able to crack down on tax cheats. And so we know that that is actually going to be reducing the deficit over time. And so this White House is actually focused on not trying to, you know, work against the Fed. If we look at the student loan reduction, That comes in tandem with increasing and restarting payments. So if we look on net, it's not so obvious that that is actually going to be pumping into the economy, especially in the near term. So we are aware the president wants to give the Federal Reserve the independence and the room it needs to bring down inflation, while nonetheless putting into place good, solid policies that help to build economic capacity so that our economy is growing in a steady, sustainable way that benefits all Americans.
Cecilia, you talked about gasoline prices, and clearly that's been an important factor in terms of boosting consumer sentiment. As you said, I'm looking at WTI now, about $90 a barrel. It's up 2.8% in the session today. But longer term, you've got OPEC, you've got that meeting next week. There's been some indications that maybe they're looking at cutting supply. You've got the Iran deal, which looks very shaky. And that's a pretty bullish way to describe what's happening with Iran. You put those things together. And then the strategic reserves as well, and they'll start to reduce, of course, at the later part of this year. You put all those things together, there's a case that oil's going to go higher from here. Those gasoline prices are not going to remain suppressed at the pump for much longer.
Well, so we understand that the price of gasoline is set on the global market and that that is sensitive to geopolitical forces. It is why Secretary Yellen is working with partners in the EU as they look and explore ways of keeping the price of oil manageable while depriving Putin of revenues. We need to bring the war in Ukraine to an end. So the president is working with partners around the world to ensure that we continue to have access to oil supply. But you're right, oil is volatile. It's why the Federal Reserve prefers to look at core inflation that strips out volatile food and energy. But where the president is doing what he can in order to keep the price of oil down.
What is your level of confidence that the decline that we have seen in inflation and the sort of cooling that we've seen in wages, and this goes to the point about gasoline, is actually transitory? I mean, if it can be transitory on the upside, why can't it be transitory on the downside?
So I'm not sure to what you're referring in the sense that we know that what the Federal Reserve's actions are designed to cool the economy. And we know that we're coming out of a global pandemic. Our economies, plural, are starting to knit back together. So we're getting back into equilibrium. And so we're seeing all the signs that that process is occurring and that we're making the transition to a more normal economy, and one that we hope with the various actions that the president has taken and the laws with this bipartisan infrastructure law, the CHIPS law, the Inflation Reduction Act, making those long needed investments in our economy so that we've built up economic capacity to help make the transition.
Yeah. That was Celia Rouse, U.S. Council of Economic Advisors, joining myself and Tom McKenzie on Bloomberg Television. So let's get the real insight from maybe the C-suite side. Joining us now is Michael Barrington Hibbert. Barrington Hibbert Associates is an executive search, leadership development, and diversity advisory firm that specializes in recruitment and retention of diverse teams. A great person to talk to on this Labor Market Day. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Alex, it's great to be invited. Thanks so much for your time. I think just listening to Cecilia's point and obviously seeing President Biden's report in terms of the labor market, it's interesting. I think when we look at the US labor market, we really need to break it down in terms of dichotomy. Of course, there's going to be a softening in the labor market. We look at Bed Bath & Beyond. We look at the Cineworlds of the world. There are going to be areas which are starting to slow down. That being said, you talk about intraday movements from an FX standpoint and intraday movement from commodities prices. But what we're not talking about is the increased wages demand taking place in the US economy. What's fascinating, Alex and Crypto, is that we are seeing that employees in the US are very much having the power when it comes to the US labor market. As I'm sure your listeners are all aware, there are two job openings for every unemployed worker. How long is this going to be sustainable? If we look across the United States of America, California has recorded its lowest unemployment rate on record. Now, we have to look at the underlying aspects of that. What is in California? We look at high growth tech companies. We're seeing organizations having to fight for talent in terms of getting the right individuals in. So we're seeing some really interesting trends taking place.
What about the wage story here? Because I think something that was buried in a fairly positive payrolls report is that average hourly earnings did rise. When you adjust for inflation, they actually fell. What is that doing in terms of spending ability and hiring ability?
Great point. Great question. Look, I think with regards to any economist, when they're looking at how they look at the labor market overheating or not, there are three components, three economic indicators that they have to look at when raise inflates. One, cost of living. Two, the housing market. And three, the labor market. So what we're seeing with regards to your question is that the pace of wages in certain sectors are not necessarily keeping pace with demand. So that's where there's a convergence. So when markets are hot, so if we look at the tech sector, we look at financial services, we look at PE or VC backed organizations, the price for talent right now is raising exponentially. Let me give you an example. As an organization which works with C-suite, so I've just came back from San Francisco 2 weeks ago, strategizing with organizations, we were retained on a mandate where the price of a chief marketing officer from the time from being engaged to execution, which took about 12 weeks, actually went up 30%. 30% to be able to get the right talent in the room. So again, I think going back to your initial question, Crypto, I think it really is dependent on the sector and also geographical location in terms of how quickly the wage prices are increasing or not.
Are you noticing any offer rescinding or anything along those lines? I mean, I feel like Snap and Beth Beyond and lots of companies at 3M laying off their workforce, and then we're seeing a lot of rescinded offers. Are you noticing that on a real-time data?
Alex, great point. Look, so what we're seeing last month, the quit rates, the resignation rates all hit a peak for the first time in 12 to 18 months. So we're seeing a higher level of resignations taking place. That being said, the buybacks are absolutely playing a factor in why these wage increases are taking place at such an astronomical rate. So again, that 30% that I mentioned earlier in the segue does factor in having to make sure that candidates are counteroffered. So those are the challenges. Those are the things which are keeping CEOs and C-suites up at night, is to fight for talent in order to be able to grow their respective organizations.
So what comes next here? I mean, when we're talking about loosening this labor market, does that mean we need to see an uptick in jobless claims? Is that the measure of success here?
Look, I'm not an economic specialist. I am in the job market every single day, speaking to organizations. I think what I would like to talk about just very briefly here is the fact that we've seen an uptick of more female participants working in the US market. And I think that's really indicative of the way hybrid working has really impacted the job market, mm-hmm. how organizations have really embraced strategic workforce planning. So in terms of forward trends, what we are seeing from the C-suites is we are seeing a number of organizations pipelining diverse talent. So this is not just happened by accident. I think organizations have been very strategic of making sure that they have been pipelining gender, underrepresented minorities coming into the workforce. So what I see as a forward in terms of the remainder of the year, I do see in terms of more underrepresented groups still going into the workforce at a high number. So again, I think those trends are going to be quite outlined over the next couple of months for sure.
Quickly, and this is about 30 seconds, Michael, there's been some talk about companies are going to hold on to workers longer this time around if there is a recession, because they don't want to go through the labor tightness that they saw over the last couple years. Are you hearing anything along those lines?
Look, I think that's a great question, Alex. I think in terms of the last 10 seconds, that is the million-dollar question. I think organizations are having to hold on to strategic decisions in terms of whether they're in or out in terms of market. Mm. I am starting to see that some organizations from an M&A standpoint, financial services, just because of the lack of M&A activity, are going to start making some cuts towards the end of the year. So I do think it's sector-specific coupled with geographics.
Michael, really great to catch up with you. An important conversation to have on an important jobs day. Michael Barrington Hibbert joining us, founder and CEO of Barrington Hibbert Associates. More on the markets next and what to do going forward. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is off today. Kriti Gupta in for Guy. Let's just take a quick check in here on the markets. You're seeing the S&P just up by about 0.1. So we're kind of fading here. The NASDAQ now down by 0.2%. We did have that headline that Gazprom will not be restarting its Nord Stream 1 pipeline due to some technical issues. I wonder if the technical issues could be the discussion among the G7 of an energy oil price cap. I'm not speculating. I'm just pointing out some timing connections here. So looking at that as well, crude up by still a full 2 percentage points. Kriti, we'll get to some more market stuff in a second. We got to talk to global equity strategist for Goldman Sachs, Peter Oppenheimer. What do you think traders are thinking right now? Like, are they actually trading something on like a macro view?
I think it's a lot of treading water, to be completely honest. And I think you're going to perhaps see, and this is why I think coming back from Labor Day is going to be so crucial, to see if people actually take advantage of more volume, which there will inevitably be. Remember, we are still in that kind of summer trading period, so there is that. I think a lot of people are waiting for that.
Volume kind of sucks right now.
It does, and that's normal for August. It's normal, but I think everyone's kind of waiting perhaps for those European traders to get back from vacation, then they'll kind of make those bets. But even in that scenario, I wonder how many people are making long-term bets right now. I was speaking to a trader a few days ago, and he was like, I don't know how to navigate this market, and people are trusting me with a whole lot of money to do that, and I don't know how. So you're just hopping in and out of positions. Technicals are driving the trade, and you're treading water.
Well, I was talking to Andrew Sheets yesterday from Morgan Stanley, and he's like, we like cash. Like, cash is actually earning you some things. Like, why would you not just stay there? Not necessarily that you're going to put it to work, but like, and you will eventually. We're not there yet, but like, it's yielding something now, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, I think when people say it's cash, it's so interesting to say, what kind of cash? Are you talking about money market funds? Are you talking about passive ETFs? Are you talking about sticking it under your mattress in physical form? Or are you buying the dollar and nothing else? I don't know what that means. So I think it's interesting because there's even nuance within that.
Like what that actually entails. So Tom McKenzie and I on television spoke with Peter Oppenheimer, our chief equity global strategist over at Goldman Sachs. And first off, we were like, give us your take on the jobs report. How do you trade it?
Well, I think overall it was a pleasing number. It may go some way to alleviate some of the concerns that have been building up since Jackson Hole. But overall, it does still, I think, suggest that we're in a period where rates have got to go higher for some time to really alleviate some of these inflationary pressures on a more sustained basis. And during the rally that we enjoyed during the summer, the market really didn't believe that. And I think we're in the process of an adjustment to reflect that reality now.
Peter, where are we in that adjustment? The higher for longer, that sustained lower growth trajectory that Jay Powell outlined, where are we in the market adjustment to that? And with the June lows, do they mark the bottom at this point?
Well, I think when you consider the prospects for inflation being higher for longer, not anything like we saw in the 1970s, and certainly some of the pressures are easing, but much higher than we've seen in the last decade. And you look at where interest rates are, and of course, some of the obvious downward risks to growth, not just in the US, but particularly in areas like China and Europe. Equities haven't really fallen that much. Most major equity markets year to date, and they peaked at the beginning of the year, are down around 15%. And I think they could fall further and valuations could come down more before we get to the sort of point where a more sustained transition into the next cycle is properly priced. We did get towards that sort of level, I think, before the June rally, when we were clearly in bear market territory. But I think the optimism about a Fed pivot, which was probably premature, led to some relief, particularly for some of those long duration stocks, which have fallen in that first phase. So I think we need to get back towards the sort of lows we were seeing before. But it's not just the level, it's also the valuation and the realistic pricing of higher terminal rates and weaker growth.
Yeah, but you know, levels are fun to talk about. So Peter, does that mean that we break 3,600? And how do we do it this time? What does it for us?
Well, I think the combination of continued strength in the labor market in the case of the US, leading to higher inflation expectations, would be something that would continue to encourage the Fed and indeed other central banks to be persistent in their message that they're determined to reduce inflationary pressures and raise rates. But of course, in combination with that, is the expectation about the extent of any economic slowdown. Now, when we look at how the market is pricing that, of course, there are many ways to do it, just simply looking at the way that the most cyclical stocks have performed relative to the most defensives, does suggest, of course, that the market is pricing a slowdown. That wouldn't be a surprise. But at this stage, it still looks to be pricing something of a soft landing. Now, we do think there are some reasons to be positive, strong private sector balance sheets, and even in those areas the most risk of growth deteriorating, like Europe, we're going to see more fiscal support. But I think the market will get to pricing more recession risk before we get a genuine turnaround.
That was Peter Oppenheimer, Chief Global Equity Strategist at Goldman Sachs. The net is that we're going to have to price in more of a recession at some point before we hit the trough.
It's interesting.
Where is it? When is it? Don't know.
Right. And it's a non-traditional recession too, right? I think that's the consensus here. This is a job full recession. How do you trade something like that? And when was the last time we've even seen this, if ever?
Never.
Yeah.
Also, it doesn't make any sense. Like a job full of recession, like that feels like an oxymoron at the end of the day. I guess also the main question for me, and I feel like now that we're through the earnings season, is what the consumer is actually going to be doing. What we're buying and how we're buying it, I feel no one knows. Not even us, consumers. And no one can really understand how the economy is going to go or how earnings are going to go without knowing that question.
Yeah, but this is where the stagflation commentary comes in, right? It's the idea that you have a strong consumer because they are, at the end of the day, they have jobs, they have an income, but they're not spending more aggressively. That isn't leading to innovation. That isn't leading to growth. So you're just kind of stuck in this cycle.
Mm-hmm. Stuck in the cycle. Are flows that way? Or is it just really, really weak? We've seen a lot of selling.
We have seen a lot of selling, but I think the flow story, and this is why September is so crucial, is going to be a flow story coming from abroad, coming into the U.S. markets. And that's going to be the litmus test, basically, to see if there is actually a bull case for the stock market here that isn't based on recession odds.
Yeah, I have to really wonder, too, what a 75-bit ECB hike does to that narrative as well. All right, Kriti, look, thanks a lot. It's been a long week for you, and I appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Always a pleasure.
She's got a rent to TV. You've been listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. Have a great weekend, everybody. Guile and I will be back with you on Tuesday. Happy weekend. This is Bloomberg.